Hi, my name is Lee. I'm an alcoholic. Should I sit? Do people usually sit? Okay. All right. So, my name is Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you very much for asking me to speak here. And, nobody's ever said I'm wise, so that's interesting. Okay, so how it was, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in 1980, November 10th, at Women's College Hospital to a mother and a father. And I don't really remember much of that. So I was living in Toronto with a mother and a father, and my father's alcoholic. He's also a cocaine addict. And we lived all over the place. Like, we moved every 6 months. And the last place we lived in when we were in Toronto was a coach house. And it was like one big room like this. And he cut out rooms, like my dad built like rooms with doors on them. My bed was right in the middle of the whole thing. And I never remember my father living there. So, anyway, I don't know. So, we moved to Montreal when I was 4 or 5 years old, where I began my school career. Prior to that, I was in daycare since I was 2. And right from the beginning, well, my mother didn't know there was anything wrong with me because I was her firstborn child. So she thought I was a little socially awkward since I didn't play with any other children. I would just watch. But when my sister was born, when I was 7 years old, she kind of freaked out because here's my sister, like, and like she was like a normal baby, like, and then here was I, like, I was already 7, and she was like totally freaking out, like, oh my god, my child's like fucked up, and I don't know what I'm a bad mother, I didn't renew it. So anyway, so she kind of sought help for me. I was I was a kid that never, I couldn't make any friends. I didn't even know how to socialize. It was like I lacked something that I didn't know how to do it. Like, I would be in the schoolyard and I would be watching all the kids doing whatever they're doing, and I wanted to join in and I wanted to play with them, but I didn't know how, and I felt very, very different. I thought for a long time that I was an alien or something like this. It didn't help that I didn't look like anybody in my family. I looked like my father's side, and he doesn't have any siblings, so we never... All my cousins looked like all the same, and I was there, and I didn't look like anybody else, and I felt very alone as a young child. And I liked school because in school, like, I liked the structure of school. I liked learning things. I was a bright kid. I was pretty smart. I could, you know, read and write and do all those kind of things, and the teachers seemed to like me, I guess, and I kind of liked them, I guess, but I started hating everybody, and a lot. Like, I wanted to kill everybody, and it was a very difficult time in my life, especially when you're a little kid. I don't know, like, I was a child, and I didn't really know what was going on. So we were living in NDG, and my father's an alcoholic, and they divorced when I was 8 or 9 years old. My sister was 2 years old, and I guess I took it kind of hard. I mean, I guess all children do, but I started pulling out all my hair, and my mother thought I was dying of some kind of disease. So she rushed me to the children's hospital, and they, you know, they diagnosed me, and they're like, look, we're going to send her to the psychiatric department here. So that's when I started therapy, when I was 8 years old. And it was very, it wasn't good. It wasn't a good thing. Like, the therapist I had for 8 years was not the therapist for me. They concluded when I quit when I was 16 that I was smarter than my therapist and that I was able to manipulate her, and that wasn't a good thing for me. So I would go there every week, and I hated it. And so my mother, we had this house in NDG. They sold the house. My mother is gay, apparently. She's gay. So she moved in with her partner when I was 10 or 11 years old, and they bought a house in Beaconsfield. And I was, like, overjoyed. I was so happy because it meant that I thought it was going to be, like, the Wonder Years, like, you know, playing street hockey and having your best friend next door. And I really liked change. I liked moving a lot. And when they bought the house in Beaconsfield, I thought it was like the best thing ever, that I was finally going to be normal, and that that I would make friends, and that's the way it's supposed to be in suburbia, right? You're supposed to, you make friends because that's what it is. You know, there's no, but anyway, so here I am, and I'm like 11 or 12 years old, and I'm starting high school, and my parents are gay, and I live in this predominantly white neighborhood. I'm white. I mean, that's the only thing going for me. That was the only thing going for me at the school. I went to Beaconsfield High School, and it was the only thing, like, it was a horrible experience. Like, I can't say enough about how horrible my high school experience was. I don't think that anybody should have to go through high school if they were like me, maybe. I don't know, but it was really horrible. And so I went there, and I was expecting to make friends, and I was like, I walk in, and I'm wearing like neon green sweatpants, and like, and like, it was horrible. So I didn't make any friends, and I got made fun of a lot, got bullied a bit, and I didn't really know what was going on, really. Like, I mean, I got really depressed by eighth grade. And tried to commit suicide one summer. I was very serious about it, and I was very, very angry when I didn't die. I was very, very angry. And I was at the Montreal Children's Hospital for a week, and I was very angry, and they kept asking me why I was so angry, and I kept telling them, because I'm fucking alive, and I want to be dead, and like you're so stupid, like all these people are so stupid, and like they don't nobody understood me, you know. And I guess all teenagers feel that way, that nobody understands them. So anyway, so that was just like a little, and then my mother, of course, was like devastated, and like the relationship between me and my two mothers after that point became very, very rocky, and I didn't get along with my stepmother anymore. It was horrible. Like I thought she hated me, and she did nothing to, you know, I guess she loved me, but she didn't know how to express it properly, and it was very, very painful. So I quit therapy when I was 16, and we were living in this big house. I had four bedrooms, and I was going to a school that I hated, with people that I hated, and I was living with people that I hated, and this great aunt of my stepmother's, who was like 95 years old, moved in with us. And she came there to die, I guess, and there was a spare room. And every day I went home for lunch, to make feed her lunch, and I wasn't resentful at all. In fact, it was like a break. I had a reason to go home at lunch. I didn't have to stay at school. And then she died, of course, because she was 95, and that's what she came there to do. And she left behind this big box of prescription medication, and my parents put it in a closet in her room. And you know, because, you know, I don't know why. I mean, it was this enormous box. And so I was, like, a pretty smart kid. I was 15 or 16. And when I was 13, I was an avid reader. And my favorite author was William Burroughs. And he wrote this book called Junkie. And it was my favorite book when I was 13. And I loved it. And I was like, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be a heroin addict. And my mother is an editor for medical magazines, so she has a lot of books on pharmacology and like all kinds of, like, you know, those Bibles that the doctors use. And so I mean, I already knew what everything was, and I just took it all, and I started using prescription medication, mainly codeine, Dilaudid, things like that, Intilform, and it was the best thing that had ever happened to me in my entire life, because I could do drugs and I could go to school and I didn't give a fuck and I didn't care. And I didn't have to care, and I didn't feel like I had to care. I had a lot of anxiety. My anxiety started when I was a teenager, and it was very debilitating. Like, I couldn't eat in public. I couldn't use a public bathroom. I couldn't, I had to wear the same clothes every day because I wanted to blend in more. And when I started using those prescription drugs, it was just like, it was the best thing. It was wonderful. And I can't say enough how much it helped me finish high school. So, and it was great. Like, I would use all week, and then I didn't have to use on the weekend because I didn't have to go to school. And so I graduated high school when I was 17 in 1998, and we were still living in Beaconsfield, and I went to John Abbott College for Stage Up and Liberal Arts program. and I really liked the courses that I was taking. And by that time, all the drugs had run out, and my parents had no clue. But so I started Stage Up, and it was like kind of like a breath of life, because there's a lot of people that go to a Stage Up, and they're kind of all different ages. Like, they're all kind of 17, 18, 19, 20, but, like, people don't really care anymore, I guess. So, and there's a lot more different kinds of people. So I made some friends. And for the first time in my life, I made friends when I was 17 or 18 years old. And it was, like, it was great. Like, I had never known, like, what it was like to have friends. And, of course, all the friends I made were drug addicts and alcoholics, I guess. But, you know, we smoked pot every day at school. And that's basically what I did for 3 years. I smoked pot for 3 years, and then I drank. I didn't drink very much, actually. When I started drinking when I was 16, but with my cousins. But it was very rare, because my father's an alcoholic, and so was the rest of my family. And I hated them for it. I despised the alcoholism, what it did to them, how they acted, what it made them do, how they smelled, how they looked when they were drunk. I hated everything about it. So I was like, I'm not going to be an alcoholic. No way. So I used drugs. Right? Seemed to make sense to me. I thought it was more dignified or something like that. So I had all these friends, and then I had a boyfriend when I was 18. He died now. He died a couple years ago, or even more than that. I guess he died when he was 19, in a car accident, a freak car accident. But, like, I thought that's the way life was supposed to be. And I did like him very much. And I think he liked me very much, too. And it was really good. And that's what I thought. That's what I thought life was like. Was like, you met, like, that's what I thought it meant to be, what it was to be straight. Like, I didn't know I was gay because my parents are gay. So I thought it was impossible. Impossible that they would raise a gay child. So, the first 20 years of my life, I didn't know that I was gay, and I thought I was straight, and that's what it was like to be straight. Of course, later on, somebody explained it to me, and then I kind of all clicked, and everything made sense. But that came a little bit later. So I was going out with this guy, and I wasn't getting along with my step parents very much at all. My stepmother, or my mother, was all right, but the communication was down. I hated my little sister, and so. When I was 18, I moved out, and I went to live with my grandparents in Lachine, and it was great, you know, because they had this room in the basement for me, and they were all elderly, like in their 80s, and it was just like I was like I rented, like I just had to help out a bit with the housework, call if I wasn't going to be home for dinner at 5, and I could come and go as I pleased, and like they were like oblivious to everything, like I was smoking cigarettes in the basement, and they didn't even know it, and they didn't smoke, and they had no clue. It was like, I thought I was brilliant. So Liam died, and then prior to his death, I met a girl, and I fell in love with her. And she lived in Dorval. She was from California. She was really, really smart. She was a genius, and any topic. And she could excel in any field, anything. Like, she could do anything. Like, and so I lived with her for 4 years. The only thing was that she was actually straight, and I knew it, and it was really horrible. It was really, really horrible. It was a really horrible, horrible, horrible relationship. Very, very painful, and it was very an addictive kind of a love where. It was just like I was hurting myself all the time. But, you know, so we were using drugs together and drinking a lot. And, you know, things were going all right. I went to Concordia for a year. And I thought, you know, I was in my early 20s. And I thought everything was perfectly all right. We moved to the plateau, to this 1.5 on St. Denis and Sherbrooke. And I thought that everything was perfect. In my life, I started using drugs daily around that time, and that was kind of like the beginning. But like, I didn't really think that there was anything wrong with that. you know, because it was my solution to my life. Like, I didn't use to have fun or to prove anything to anybody. I didn't use for any particular reason except that I needed it to survive. Like, I couldn't survive. I was, like, anxious and depressive, and, like, they even diagnosed me as slightly agoraphobic, where I couldn't leave the house because I was so scared. And, I mean, it was my tool for survival. So, I mean, when I started using and drinking daily, it was, I was self-medicating myself. Like, I needed it. And, like, who was anybody to tell me that I couldn't survive in life? Like, what do you want me to do? Die? Like, so that was my logic there. So I was living with this girl, and then a boyfriend of hers moved in. And later on we were, like, living, like, four or five people in this little one and a half. But she was a stripper, my ex-girlfriend, and I thought it was really, really glamorous. Very glamorous. And I would panhandle outside the strip club that she worked every night and make about $100 every night. And we'd use drugs. And I thought it was really romantic and beautiful and perfect. But I was pretty fucking miserable, really, on the inside, because I needed all these things to be a certain way in order to survive. I had to have certain amounts of drugs and alcohol, and I was always, like, hoping that she would be gay. And she, of course, like, it's not how it works, right? So anyway, it kind of goes on the same way. Like, I'm living in this place, and we're using drugs, and, like, things are getting really horrible, and I don't know, like, I was working. It was, like, kind of like what I hear every night when I go to a speaker meeting, like, drank, and then this happened, and it was bad, and then I kind of hit a bottom, and then I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die, but then I wake up, and I feel a little bit better, and then I use more, and then, like, it's kind of stupid, like, I don't know. Anyway, so, like, I was using a lot of, like, my drugs of choice were about alcohol and pot, and I would use that in the morning, kind of to just kind of smooth things out for the day, because I was a Ritalin addict for 2 or 3 years, which is, like, really it was a really horrifying time in my life. Like, it's a horrifying drug. It's really, really, really horrifying. Like, later on I became a heroin addict, and I can't say the same about heroin. Like, I can say that about Ritalin. It's horrifying. It was, like, it was horrible. And I was also a PCP addict, and I don't know, at some point the combination, I don't know, it was like I started getting really crazy. And really, really crazy, and like things started happening that like I didn't know how they were happening. I guess I was having like psychotic blackouts. One night I tried to kill somebody in my apartment. And he was going to call the police, but he was too scared that they were going to like find drugs or something and then like arrest us. So he was so scared that I was going to kill him. And then I was like, well, and I had no like recollection of what had happened. And another night I woke up, several nights I woke up in St. Luke's Hospital, and like everything was like bright white, and I was there, and like I didn't know where I was, and I would like get up, and I was covered in these little endorphin patches, and I thought they were like alien patches, and I would like against the wall like this, right? And like just start like along the wall, and I would just walk out of the hospital, like I didn't even know where I was. I lived on St. Denis, though, and that hospital is on St. Denis. It was great because I would come out and I would look up and I would see the street signs and I would see St. Denis, and I'd be like, that's great because I live on that street. So if I go this way or that way, I'm going to get home. And then I would go home, and I would wake everybody up, and I would be like, oh my God, I have these alien things on me. And they would be like trying to calm down, and it was kind of like a nightmare, I guess. But it was drama, and that's what I kind of fed off of too, I guess. So, like, things were kind of falling apart, I guess you could say, and at that time in my life, the girl that I'd been in love with, I mean, she was just like, she used just as many drugs as I did. But she thought I had this big problem because I was crazy, and she wasn't. And, like, she locked me in the apartment a few times, and I slept on the roof, I slept in her car. And, you know, I carried a rope in my pocket for a while trying to hang myself. And I was so angry because all the rooms were like this, kind of. Like, there was nowhere to hang myself on. And it was really, really frustrating because I had this big fucking rope in my pocket and I didn't have anywhere to hang myself. And then, you know, then I would feel better and I'd be like, okay, and I just put it away. And then, So one day I was just like, so I was living in this apartment with these girls. I had two girlfriends and a boyfriend, and we were all kind of sleeping together. And this, my brother, he's my adopted brother, who's still my brother today. He was totally sober, schizophrenic, sleeping in the corner. And then there was a lot of other kids there living there, often all my friend Adrian. And it was quite chaotic. And I decided that, you know, my life was out of control and that I had to do something about it because I was going to die. And I was really prepared to die. Like, I was okay with that. I was really, really okay with that. I called Death, Mother Death, and it was an actual being, and it lived in my apartment. And it was hiding, and, like, it would come out and get me in time, and then I would get really mad at night sometimes. And I would start screaming at her, like, just come and get me. Like, just kill me. Like, come on. Like, what are you waiting for? So it was really crazy. And so I started using heroin because, like, you know, the rest wasn't working for me anymore. Like, I was going crazy, like, literally. And it just wasn't working for me. And I thought, you know what? It worked for William Burroughs. It can work for me. He's a smart guy. He's, like, in his 80s. Like, if he died, I guess, in his 80s. And I mean, he was a brilliant writer. He lived a fantastic life. He was a heroin addict. I mean, I can do that, too. Right? I was a writer. And so we all were using heroin in this apartment within, like, a week. And it was a shooting gallery, I guess you could say. And it was, like, a pretty horrible place, I guess. My mother called it the closet. It was a 1.5, and it was tiny. It was tiny, and we were like 5 people living there. And like there was cats and rabbits, and we had rabbits. We had cats, and we even had a dog for a while. And like I don't even know what happened to all those animals, but they were all living there with us. And the landlord once came in, and he called us a fire hazard because you couldn't get from one end of the apartment to the other without having to move like bicycles and like furniture. And the worst thing about it was that I kept ODing. Like, I think I OD'd every single month for 6 straight months. And every time that it happened, the paramedics would come in and they would, like, revive me or whatever. They said it was, my friends told me it was like the living dead. Like, I was dead and then I was, like, standing up and walking around. But the paramedics had to move all our furniture, like, out of the apartment to get in. So it was like this big thing because they have all this gear and like they have to carry everything in, and then all my friends would be angry at me because like all this stuff was like strewn about the hallways of the apartment building, and you know, and then like there was like here I am with these paramedics and they want to take me to the hospital, and I'm there and I'm like, are you crazy? Like, I'm not going to go with you. And it was always an argument, and it was always like, no, 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 I'm not going. And then they were like, you have to, because they have to legally bring you there. And then it was like, and I knew I didn't want to go because I knew it cost $125 for them to take me to the hospital. That's how much it costs for every hospital ride you take, plus mileage. So, and I lived, I lived 5 blocks from St. Luke's Hospital, and I knew that's where they were taking me. So I was like, well, why can't I just walk there behind the ambulance? Like, like, what's the big problem, you know? Like, what's wrong with you people? And like, the paramedics would be like, you know, they have to call the police if you don't go with them. So then I would be like, okay, I'm going. And then, so then I'm there, and I'm, like, arguing with this, like, paramedic, and, like, he's, like, finally one time, it was usually the same ones, or I don't know, but they were, he was, like, finally, like, I'm so sick, he told me, I'm so sick and fucking tired of you. He's, like, you know, we save your life, and all you have to say is, like, you spitting at us, like, your heart was going to stop. And I'm like, well, then why don't you just let me die? And then they're like, oh, my God, it's our job. Like, we have to. And it was just like, it was, and then I'd go to the hospital, and then I'd be, like, yelling at everybody, like, I don't want to see the doctor because I want to sign myself out immediately, and then I have to walk home from the hospital. Like, and somebody always forgot to bring my shoes, and it would be, like, October or November, you know, and I would be mad at them, and then I don't know. And then we started this thing where, like, every time somebody had to go to the hospital, which seemed to happen quite often, we'd bring all the cats, and we'd all dress up. we'd all dress up, and I would wear a dress and like makeup, and like a William would wear a tie, and like it was like this big thing. We'd all walk into St. Luke's Hospital, and like I don't know. I guess it was kind of romantic in a way. So anyway, like I guess things weren't going that well for me. Not well. I mean, I was 90 pounds at this point. My hair was falling out from malnutrition. I was scared. I couldn't ride a bicycle anymore. I couldn't run because of my heart. I thought I was going to stop at any moment. We were passing diseases to each other. We had fleas. Like garbage. I don't know. Like, it was just dirty. And like, so one day my mother came over for a visit. She was terribly worried about me, and I told her there was absolutely nothing for her to worry about because I was completely normal, and that I was living a normal life, and that these were my friends, and that everything was fine, and I was going to get married to this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man named William. Yeah, I lived with a guy named William, and we were actually going to get married very seriously for no particular reason, except for that I thought that if I got married and had children that I would somehow become like a normal functional member of society. Not that I wasn't a normal functional member of society, but you know, things are like pretty crazy. One time, like I would do things like I just wanted to die, so I would run out like out of my apartment, like all fucked up and like with bare feet and like raining in October, screaming at everybody, like, fuck you, like just yelling at people, and finally some people would get really mad at me and like wanted to beat me up, and I would be like, just do it, like come on, and I would be like spitting at them, telling them I had AIDS and stuff, and like just like really intense like confrontations. I was picking fights with a lot of people on the street, and like really bad. So my mother came over for a visit, and both my mothers came over, and they were like, we want to take you out for supper. And I was like, I think it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday, and I was sleeping, and my friend Adrian answered the door, and he said, you know, Lee's sleeping right there, because it's like 1:30, right, in the closet. And I was like, well, wake up, like we're going out for dinner. And I was like, no, like, this is crazy. I'm like, you didn't call ahead. I mean, how could you possibly think that I could alter my plans for the afternoon? But I went, and we got in the car, and the next thing I know, we're driving on the highway, and I'm like, this is not, like, we're not going to supper. Like, this is, like, where are we going? And then we're in Beaconsfield again. It was a nightmare. I was like, oh, my God. And I didn't have anything with me. I didn't have any money or bus pass or keys or anything. Nothing. And I was like, this is, like... So anyway, they're like, you have to go to rehab. That's it. Like, you're going to die. And I was like, I know. I didn't say that to them. I was like... I wanted to leave, and then it was like, you know, I went really, like, I was sick, you know, like, physically sick, you know, within, like, 8 hours, and, like, I was, like, crazy, you know, and, like, they didn't know what to do, they had no idea, and they were, like, calling, like, the Info Santé line, like, she's detoxing from heroin, what do we do? And I was like, take me to a hospital, I want to go to a hospital, and they were like, no, we're not going to take you to a hospital, because you can escape from a hospital, and, my mother, like, at one point she took me into the car, told me we were going to a hospital, and she drove to the country. We have a country house. And it was November, and it was cold there. And, like, so, like, let me tell you, if you're detoxing from anything, you don't want to be in a cold, unheated house in the middle of nowhere. You're not. So I was, anyway, it was pretty horrible. So, I know, so I went to rehab. I went to Bellwood. And I suppose that's where my recovery started. I went to Bellwood. It's in Toronto. I was there for 3 months. It was really good for me because I was really kind of crazy. And then, like, when I wasn't on drugs anymore, I felt like I did again when I was like 14 or 15, like prior to starting to use and drink. I felt like I was very anxious and depressed, and like my moods were like really, really, really unstable. And it was a good place for me to be because they have, like, you can see psychiatrists and things like this. And like I'm dual diagnosis, like I suffer from, you know, slight mental illness. I mean, so they got me on a little bit of medication there, but it wasn't like what I needed. But it kind of like smoothed things out a little bit. But it was like a joke to me, the whole place. Like, I thought it was great. It was like a hotel, and they even like vacuumed your floor and stuff. And and I learned a lot of things there. Like, I learned basic, like, health needs. Like, you know, you got to bathe every day. And you got to, like, change your sheets. I didn't even know about the changing sheets thing until, like, I think 2.5 months into it. Apparently, they brought this whole thing with sheets out every Thursday night. And I had no clue. And, like, 2.5 months later, I was like, what's that? And they're like, change sheets. And I'm like, change sheets. I'm like, why? What do you mean, change sheets? And my sheets were, like, gray, you know, like... And they were like, the nurse was like freaking out. Was like, oh my god, I can't believe you haven't changed your sheets in 2.5 months. And I was like, change sheets? I'm like, I don't even get it. I was like, what are you talking about, change sheets? Like, like, who does that? Like, what? Like, it was, I was baffled, you know, by all these things. I was baffled. I'm like, bathe once a day. I'm like, isn't that bad for your skin? Like, don't the natural oils, like, they don't replenish? And like, you know, all these things. It was just, you know, and I saw a doctor there, and like apparently I was relatively healthy. Although they didn't let me exercise for the first month. I don't know why. But so I was there, and it was a big joke. I went to my first AA meeting at Bellwood in-house meeting. I don't remember much of it. I just remember there was coffee and cookies, and I enjoyed that very much. It was kind of like summer camp, really, there. Like, you kind of get dragged from activity to activity, and you gotta behave at each one and not get kicked out, and I wouldn't. And it seemed like everybody really liked me. Like, all the staff really, really liked me, and I was like the most unideal patient, I guess. Like, I was like, I acted out a lot, and I like swore. It was like stupid, you know. Like, I was like a kid. I felt like I was 14, and that kind of makes sense. And they told me that makes sense because you start using when you're 15 or 16. So like, actually, socially and mentally, you still are like a 15-year-old. And then I was like 22 or 23 at the time, and I didn't know what they were talking about. So, but it was very good for me because I got my health back, and I gained, I think, 35 pounds in 3 months. And I looked very healthy again, and I was exercising, I started lifting weights, and, you know, I made all these friends. Apparently I was very popular. That's what my therapist told me. I was a very popular patient. It shocked me because, I mean, my other experiences with, like, institutions like school was where, like, I was, like, a total freak. So I had all these friends, and it was really, really good for me to go because it kind of, like, it kind of put me, like, in a position where it was, like, look at your life. You're fucked up. And and I had to argue it, right? I argued it for, like, 3 months, and finally I was like, yeah, okay, you know. Okay, so I need some help here. So I kind of, like, gave in, and, you know, I did all the movements. Like, I did everything that you were supposed to be doing. Like, you know, fake it till you make it, you know. They told me when I got back to Montreal that I should get a sponsor, and that I should choose a home group immediately, and that I should go to aftercare for a few months, and that I would continue seeing a therapist and a psychiatrist and, like, all these wonderful things. And so I went back to Montreal, not really, like, thinking that I was going to stay sober, but part of my brain was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do, I guess. Like, you know, that's what I'm supposed to do now. But I kind of knew that I wasn't. So I relapsed, like, I think the second day when I go back to Montreal. And I ended up in the hospital again. Like, I had some kind of a psychotic episode immediately. And that was, like, very shocking to me. Like, I was very shocked. You know, like, very shocked that that would happen immediately. And I hadn't even used, like, any, like, psychotic drugs, like, you know, so it was, like, pretty, like, my mother was very upset. It was her birthday, apparently, I think, and I had no clue. So, yeah, so I was living with my parents in Beaconsfield again, and I started working, and, you know, I had this deal, like, all these deals, like, I was, like, kind of, like, on probation at my mother's house, where, like, I had to stay sober, and if I didn't, I had to go to a women's shelter or something, and it was all, like, kind of bullshit, because I didn't think they'd actually do it. At one point, they sent me to a detox for 12 days, which I promptly got kicked out of. I mean, I don't even know how I got kicked out of it. I mean, I just got kicked out. It was this place up north. It was French, and it was, like, totally not the place for me. Like, I figured out how to break into the... They had, like, the place where they kept all the medication in the doctor's room. We figured out how to break into that, and it wasn't even locked. And, like, it was just, like, and I was, like, telling my parents in the car when they came to pick me up, I was like, they're so stupid there. Like, they're they're so stupid, like, you know, and I had this, like, I had the inferiority, superiority complex where I always think that I'm smarter than everybody, and yet I am completely inferior to everybody, and so, you know, I had a rough start, let's just say, in recovery, but I was, I joined a 12-step, group where, like, we did all the steps, like a 17-week workshop, and I did that, and I got up step 7. I did a 5th. I got a sponsor immediately. I did do that, and I got a home group, which is still my home group today, still my sponsor today. He's a great guy. Really, really good. And, you know, I did my 4th and my 5th with him, which was really amazing. It was really, really amazing. I was still relapsing. I would get, like, maybe, like, 6 or 7 or 8. I think 9 months was my max. And then I would always relapse. And then by this point, I was living in NDG. I had my own apartment, my own place. And I was living with my dog. My parents gave me my dog back when I was sober. And I had a job. And, like, things were, like, pretty stable in my life. Pretty stable. But there was something... I wasn't clicking yet. Like, the program wasn't still complete. Like, it made sense to me. Like, I understood what to do, and I knew what to do. I just didn't feel what to do. Like, I didn't feel like anything that people talk about. Like, I didn't feel it. I didn't spiritual experience God. Like, I prayed, and I did all those kinds of things, sort of, but I didn't, like, you know, when I was doing my steps, like, and it just wasn't, like, I felt like it wasn't really working for me, but then I was like, how is it supposed to work for me? So, anyhow, all my friends, or so-called friends prior to this time, were all either dead or in jail, or still using drugs, and they claimed, my ex-girlfriend that I lived with for 4 years claimed to be sober, and she was living in San Francisco, where she's from, so she told me she had about 3 or 4 months sobriety, and I had about 7 at the time. And this was in December 2004, and I decided to go visit her. I had 2 weeks vacation from work, unpaid, but I decided that I would take a trip, you know, on holiday. That's what people do when they go on holiday. They go on trips, they go places, so I decided to go visit. And also go visit another ex-girlfriend who lives in Los Angeles. At the same time, kind of split up the trip. Planned it all out, got a bus ticket beforehand, thought I would, you know, I would actually do some sightseeing while I was there. I'd never done that on vacation before. And so I arrived in San Francisco Airport. I took an airplane. Oh, yeah, the airport. And I got off the plane, and she didn't even have a day, this girl. She didn't even have a day. She was high when I met her at the airport. It was like, and I guess I kind of knew, you know, like, you kind of know these things, I guess. I kind of knew I was going to relapse, but I kind of was, like, trying to fool myself. And everybody was telling me, my sponsor, my therapist, everybody in the program, my friends in the program were all telling me, like, no, 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 there's a bad idea, bad, 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 bad. Don't go, there's a bad person, she's no good. She's like, no, 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 and I went, and I relapsed, and it was, like, the most horrifying. Like, you know, it's true what they say, that it just gets worse, never better. Like, it's absolutely true, like, it was like, and I could see it, you know, like, usually I don't see it, like, you don't see these things, I guess, maybe, but I saw it, and I was like, I'm cheating more, and I'm stealing more, and I'm lying more, and I'm using more than I ever had before. Like, it was like, she lived in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, I don't know if anybody's familiar with that area, but it's not a very good area. It's kind of like the Tenderloin of drugs, really, and, like, all kind of concentrated in one little chunk in San Francisco, and you can't even, like, walk, like, 3 feet without getting offered drugs or something. Like, it was, like, very, like, I've never seen anything like that here in Montreal. And then I went to L.A., and, you know, this girl that I'd lived with her prior, she was also straight, but, you know, something terrible happened to her where she shot this bacteria, and it went into her heart, so she just had heart surgery, major heart surgery. And so she couldn't use drugs, and she couldn't drink, and she couldn't even really, she wasn't even supposed to be smoking cigarettes. She had, like, an open line in her arm. She was still getting, like, 4 hours of IV drugs at home. And, like, I went to visit her, and we relapsed together. And to this day, I don't know if she's still alive, but like I kind of feel guilty because if she died, I mean, people tell me like you can't make somebody drink. Like you can even like bring someone to a bar, you can do anything, but you can't make them drink. Like it's their decision. So the fact that I went there and I was totally fucked up, and of course she knew it, and then you know we went out and we used and drank and you know she might be dead today, but I don't know. I don't know. So then I went back to San Francisco, and then I flew back to Montreal, and I was like, so I was sitting in my apartment, and I was totally alone with my dog, and like he was lonely. My dog was lonely. Like he was sad, and I knew he was sad because I would come home and I would just lock myself in the bathroom immediately, even though there was nobody else in the apartment, and use. Even before walking him, which is not very nice at all, and he'd be scratching at the door and crying, peeing on the floor, and I wouldn't give a fuck. And it was really horrible. I think that was my bottom, because I was very, very alone, and I didn't have any friends left in the city that used. I mean, I had a dealer, but I suppose I could have made some friends, but I was kind of beyond that now. Like, I don't know. And I had friends in the program, and I would... Every day I would use or drink, and I would immediately go to a meeting, like, totally fucked up. And I would sit there, and it would just be like this big, like, oh, my God. Like, I'm, like, this is it. I thought it was over. I thought I didn't have another recovery left in me. I didn't think that it was possible. I didn't think it was possible to get sober again. I didn't think it was. Like, I was like, this is it. Like, I'm fucked, you know? Like, this is it. And then my brother came back. My brother, he's my best friend. I met him when I was using, and he was completely sober. He's never even really smoked a cigarette. He's never had, I think he's had one drink in his whole life. He's never had sex. He's like 22 years old, completely crazy. Like, I think he's schizophrenic, and he came back, and because he's kind of like transient. Like, he just kind of goes from place to place, and he came home, and I was like totally fucked. And he's adamantly against drugs and alcohol and cigarettes. He adamantly hates them, because the government controls them. And the government are aliens. And the aliens are evil. Therefore, why me? He thinks of me as his sister and a being of the light. And I cannot be controlled by the evil beings. So that was why I could not use drugs anymore, he said to me. And so... he was like very upset, and we got in a big fight, and he took everything out of the house, and he disappeared, and he came back, and he like locked me in my apartment, and he's bigger than me, and I couldn't get out, and I was freaking out. And then I called a very good friend of mine in the program, and he took me to a meeting, and he gave me a suggestion, and I followed his suggestion, and that's when I had a spiritual experience, because I got sober. And there was no way that I could have gotten sober on my own. There was no way that I could have done it without having a spiritual experience. Because it wasn't me that was getting me sober. It was God that was getting me sober, that was keeping me sober during those, like, 7, 8, 9, 10 really shaky days when you're just, like, getting sober again. And it's like, you know, like, really what's happening. And you're not feeling so great. And I was really, really anxious. And, very scared and didn't really know what was going on. So, and I thought like it wasn't possible. Like I didn't think it was possible, but apparently God thought it was possible. And I started praying every day during those 7 to 10 days. I started praying every morning on my way to work. I had a little copy of the Big Book, and I would read the third step prayer continuously until I got to work on the bus and the metro. And that really helped me a lot. And I started calling my sponsor every day. I called him every day for like a few months there. And that was really good. I went to a one meeting a day. So I did about 7 or 8 meetings a day for about 6 months to a year, I think, that first year. And I stayed sober. But the thing was that it was different this time than all those other times, than that year and a half prior to this time, because my perspective had changed, and the wanting to drink, like the craving, like the had been lifted from me. Like I didn't want to anymore. I didn't, it wasn't even like part of me anymore, really. Like, it was very, it's very separate from me now. And, you know, I was still, like, I wasn't really struggling anymore. That was, it was kind of, it was very shocking. It was like, I could kind of like go through a day and it was just like, it wasn't easy, but it wasn't horrible either. And I wasn't on a pink cloud because I knew that, because I was questioning myself if it was a pink cloud. And it hasn't really changed all that much since. And I went back to school when I was 4 months sober at that time. And I graduated, and now I'm working in a daycare with 2-year-olds. And it baffles me because I didn't think that it was possible. I mean, I'm in charge of the life of several 2-year-olds every day. And they love me, and the parents like me. And the children stay alive every day in my care. No major head traumas yet, like nothing, like, it, you know, and like nobody knows, like it's weird. People at work think I'm a normal human being. Like they don't think that I'm crazy, they think I'm a really nice person. That's like really like outstanding and like normal. And then sometimes I'm like sitting there at lunch or something and I'm like, oh my God, like this is not right. Like, oh my God, like they're going to find me out. Like, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not supposed to have a good life. I'm not supposed to be happy. Like, what's going on, you know? So that's where I am today. I try not to get too cynical. It's one thing I'm struggling with today. I do between 3 and 5 meetings a week now. Go to my home group every week. I do service at the Douglas Hospital. And at my home group, and I have a sponsor who I'm in contact with regularly, several times a week, and I see him at least once a week, and I am available to help people if they so desire my help, I guess. I haven't had a sponsor yet. I had a sponsor for about a week. It's difficult. I like one, but I'd like to do another 4th and 5th this winter. I think it would be really good for me. Things have come up, I guess, maybe. So I have to say that I have a good life and that it's a miracle. This program is a miracle because it's impossible to explain for me. Like, it's a miracle. So thank you very much. Karen.